This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Listen to us on KPFK, KPFA, and other Pacifica stations, and watch us on Free Speech TV, Monday through Friday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos, just about a month after winning the Nobel Peace Prize, oversaw the negotiation of a historic peace accord that is meant to formally end one of the most politically violent chapters in his nation's history. In a move that shocked the world, Colombians narrowly voted against ratifying the peace deal in early October. Now, this new attempt at salvaging what voters rejected circumvents direct democracy. The talks for the original peace deal that brought together Colombian government officials with representatives of the rebel group FARC were hosted by Cuba, a nation that lost its greatest leader over the weekend. Fidel Castro passed away at the age of 90. My guest is Hector Aristizabal. He is a therapist, psychologist, actor, artist, and activist, and the founder and artistic director of Imagine Action. He is a survivor of torture and originally from Colombia, and has been closely following the politics of the Colombia peace deal. Welcome to the program, Hector.
Thank you, Sonali.
So very briefly, the original peace deal narrowly lost a voter referendum in early October. And the reasons for that loss are varied, but some people were upset that the leftist rebels were being given too much leeway. Human Rights Watch was upset about it. This do-over, as some are calling it, how different is it from the original deal that voters narrowly rejected?
Well, the answer will depend on who you ask. Apparently, many of the leaders of the no, especially our former president, Álvaro Uribe, are saying that
he's
the leader of the no vote, is still complaining that the changes that were made are not sufficient and are not to his liking. A lot of the changes were made in what he was saying, that it was too lenient towards the guerrilla fighters in terms of the justice that was going to be applied, the transitional justice programs. So I understand that there are lots of changes. I have not been able to read everything myself. I just read some commentaries. Apparently, it's the point in which the most concessions were made by the guerrilla. We have to remember that this is a peace negotiation between the Colombian government and the guerrilla. It's not between the representatives of the NO and many other organizations and the guerrilla. Immediately after the referendum was won in a very polarized vote, we spoke about last time, by the people who were against the ratification of the negotiations, both the government and the guerrillas were back to the negotiating table. The government first met with the people who represented the no, took all the recommendations, synthesized them, and went back to the negotiating table. And in, I think it was 51 days of discussion, they came out with this new document that now the government wants it to be ratified by the Colombian Congress and the Colombian House of Representatives. And they want to use something called the fast track. Instead of having 8 discussions in Congress and the House of Representatives, they're asking for 4. And they are moving very fast on that because they know time is very important right now, with all the guerrilla fighters demobilized. They don't want this them to go back to potential fighting. And also, we know that 71 community organizers had been killed since January of this year in Colombia. 2 were killed this last weekend, and 5 received assassination attempts. And many are receiving right now death threats.
Wow.
Which is one of the big... I think it's one of the big issues, is how is the government going to guarantee that the guerrillas who demobilize are not going to be killed by the paramilitary death squads.
Right, and that was a big concern, how to integrate these thousands of people who had been engaged in this warfare back into society. But I want to step back for a minute, Hector. You said that the government took all of the concerns of the group that were pushing for no on the referendum. Did they have to do that, or was that a courtesy extended by the government? Because you said this was a negotiation between the Santos government and the leadership of the FARC to end this war. Did they really even need to bring in the concessions, especially since now they're going to go to Congress to ratify it and not have another public referendum?
Well, this was not necessary. Not even the referendum was necessary. In the past negotiations between the government of Álvaro Uribe and the paramilitary death squads, Álvaro Uribe never asked anyone. He negotiated the peace process, quote-unquote peace process, with them in his own terms. The Congress, Colombian Congress, only rejected when he wanted these people to come and be part of the government. And also, they were asked to confess to their crimes in whatever way they wish. They were not, for example, now the guerrilla and also everybody who has been involved in the war, including the army, who, as we talked about last time, had been involved in the killing of at least 3,000 falsos positivos people. So they will have to respond to that, and they will have to respond to who gave those orders, which many people would say they will have to be overseen by the president, which in that case was Álvaro Uribe. But in any case, anyone who has been involved in the war is being asked to tell the truth. There will be a special judge who will see case by case and will apply the transitional justice between 5 and 7 years for those who committed crimes associated to their guerrilla fighting, including the people who use the trafficking of drugs to finance the guerrilla fighting, not those who use it for their personal wealth. So this is a very difficult point in the negotiation, and not so much in the agreement. I think the big question right now is how they are going to implement these 7,000, 8,000 guerrillas who are going to go back to civil society. The fact that they want to become a political party and want to participate in the coming elections in 2018, they are already talking, Timochenko, the head of the FARC, is already talking about a coalition of different parties to be able to guarantee that the agreements that they are being signed right now are going to be followed by the next government. So Colombia is in a big transition right now.
So let's talk about the mechanics of this new version, you know, version 2.0 of this deal. Congress, the two houses of Congress, will be asked to fast track it and vote it up or down. What is the timeline for that, and what is the likelihood that that will happen? I understand that Santos is likely to have a majority backing him.
That's the mathematics that they are making. Yet we don't have any guarantee. Even the first signing of a paper, the receiving the papers, was only 54 votes against 54 against 52, and the party that represents Uribe left the chambers. They were not present for these votes. And so we know there is going to be a very strong opposition to this process. And in a democracy, we might say it's very important to have a strong opposition. The problem will be if the opposition is going to transform these discussions into a circus. And many people are saying that's very likely, because it will allow Uribe to delay the process long enough for many guerrilla fighters to go back into the field, because they're not going to be waiting in limbo or waiting to be killed and or not knowing what to do. And then it will mean that now the country will enter into chaos again. Some people are already talking about feeling like in the late 80s, 90s, when I left Colombia, when there was killings, there were killings everywhere of intellectuals, of leftist people, of community organizers, et cetera, of artists. So they are afraid that this will happen. And then the country will be asking once again for a savior and a hero, like many see President Uribe. And it looks like that's something that he might be wanting to do, is to delay the process for as long as possible so the current agreement will not be implemented.
So he has some future political ambitions, it looks like.
No doubt.
Hector, let's talk about Cuba and the passing of Fidel Castro. I mentioned Cuba hosted the many months of talks that led to the crafting of the original agreement, and our FARC leadership are currently, in a way, in exile in Cuba. And this is, you know, such a tiny nation, if you will, in Latin America, yet has had such an outsized footprint on the politics of the continent and the region precisely because of Castro's revolution. So this weekend, seeing the passing of Fidel Castro, how is it felt both by Cubans and Colombians, and even particularly those backers of the Colombian backers of the peace deal?
Well, for me, I can tell you more about my personal reactions first, and then because both the guerrilla, I was born in 1960, and just 1 year after the Cuban Revolution was declared in 1959. So Castro and Che were figures that were very important in my upbringing, and especially during my university years. We had images of both in every wall in our university, and talking about Cuba as this very small island that had been able to say no to the empire that we all knew, the empire, the American empire or American imperialism, and how this small island with less than 10 million people had been able to confront for the last 60 years the power of the empire has been an example not just for Latin Americans, but for many people around the world. I had been in Cuba three times, and when I went there, I had been in love with the Cuban Revolution, the ideals of equality, the accomplishments that they gained in the first 15, 20 years of the revolution. They made the island completely literate, something that has not been accomplished, not even in the United States. The birth rate is higher than the United States, all the accomplishments in education, in health, in sports, in culture, etc. But yet, at the same time, when I returned to Cuba, I could see also the lack of freedom for people, and how people who were not from the generation that suffer the conditions of Batista and the conditions of the island being practically a casino and a prostitute for tourists, mostly American tourists. And yes, they accomplish all these things. They receive a lot of help from Russia. And then when Russia collapsed, they were able to survive with incredible efforts. And in the last few years, especially with Chavez in power in Venezuela, they receive a lot of help through Venezuelan oil. And Venezuela asking Cuban doctors and teachers to go to Venezuela and to go to Bolivia and to go to Ecuador, etc. But so Castro signified for many people a leader that was able to confront the United States, and with incredible rhetoric, with incredible oratory, with incredible analysis for the poor and the disenfranchised and the oppressed. But on the other hand, we also could see that he became a dictator, that he was a person who, I mean, Cuba has been governed by him and his brother, Raul, and now they're talking that probably after Raul will be his current vice president. So that's a legacy that many of us would not understand, neither as socialism or communism or any ism. It's a dictatorship. And so it's a very controversial, larger-than-life figure. And for me, it's very interesting that in this week, when the FARC, the oldest guerrilla group in the Western Hemisphere and in the world, is now changing their ways and their politics and the way that they want to exercise their political ideals. And then the death of Fidel Castro is like the death of an era, this era of imposing socialism through the armed struggle. I think that's over for everywhere in the world.
Well, Hector, it certainly remains to be seen how both Cuba and Colombia's future now unfolds, particularly in an era when even sort of democratic means don't always give the kinds of outcomes we might expect. I mean, we all associate democracy with greater peace, justice, and freedom. And yet, this past year has been a very interesting one with Brexit, with the defeat of the Colombia vote, and with the U.S. election of Donald Trump. And it's enough to make one sort of really doubt the ways in which democratic processes can function. Is the lesson that sometimes democracy is just too much power put in the hands of people, or that democracy can be more easily manipulated, particularly through the media, et cetera?
And especially where we have more a plutocracy and the reign of the very wealthy. It's an incredible times that we're living. And I think when there is so much chaos outside, what is happening right now in North Dakota with the pipeline and the defenders of the water, the defenders of the earth, and their prayerful ways of engaging against the ravages of capitalism or the industrial growth society, I think we are in a very exciting moment in the world and in the United States and in Colombia. I think Colombians have to now imagine what will it be like to live in a country in peace, and the United States has to imagine now how will it be to survive Trump. What I hope is that a lot of people will be able to wake up finally, because we have been very dormant under the Obama administration. And I hope that people like Bernie continue what he's doing, and that all of us contribute with whatever it is that we came here to the world to do.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Hector, for joining us today. Good luck to you.
Thank you, Sonali. Take care.
My guest is Hector Aristizabal. He's a therapist, psychologist, actor, artist, and activist, and the founder and artistic director of Imagine Action, which is a nonprofit theater arts organization. He is originally from Colombia and a survivor of torture. He's been closely following the politics of the Colombian peace deal. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/RUWithSonali.